Here we go, chapter 17. We're in verse 24. Right now we're in the middle of Paul talking on the Areopagus, or Mars Hill, because they're both called the same thing. The Areopagus is also called, is the name for what? The Council of 30 Men that meets on Mars Hill that actually deliberates things. So it has a double meaning. And I did say, by the way, I did say yesterday, hey, it'd be a good test question, the key beliefs of the Epicureans and the Stoics. I didn't put that on the test, so it would be a good test question, but maybe for future dates, not for this year. All right, so he's talking with them, but what are the Epicureans, what are some of their key beliefs?
Pleasure.
What?
Pleasure.
Yeah, that pleasure is the highest goal. Highest goal. What else? Matter is eternal. There never was a time when the world was not. What's the other one? The soul is not immortal. When you die, it's over. What about the Stoics? Self-denial is the highest goal of living. Which is number two? Zeus created the world. Number three? The soul is immortal. Now, both of them, though, unite on a couple of points. The key point they unite on is that both of them are trying to free themselves from fate. They hate the concept of fate. The way Epicureans free people from fate is they say it doesn't exist. And so that's the way they say everything can logically or reasonably be accounted for. And the Stoics just refuse to react to fate's stimulant. They refuse to react in any way, shape, or form, thereby ignoring the existence of it altogether and freeing themselves from it. That'll become important because of what we're talking about now. Chapter 17, verse 24. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. Who would that make mad? The Epicureans. Why? Because they don't believe that matter ever was created. It always existed. So right off the bat, he says, actually, there is a God that made the world. And the Stoics are going, yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Is the Lord of the heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. That would have ticked them all off. Because all they need to do from Mars Hill is do a 360 look around and you can see all the temples to all the gods that are around them. And really what Paul is going to be really targeting is what's distressed him earlier on in this passage. The amount of idols that are existing in this city. Matter of fact, he'll even somewhat start making fun of it in a similar way that Jeremiah made fun of it. Jeremiah, I love this. I love it in Jeremiah. Actually, I don't have written down where it is. But he says at one point, he says, when you go out and cut down a tree, you'll use half for firewood and you use half to fashion the god. How do you know you got the right half? What if you're burning the God part and you carved the firewood part? He looks at me and says, you see how stupid that is? You made the God. How is that worthy of worship? If you can make the God, then you're basically saying it's really not able to do what you, the worshiper, have to do for it. So why is that logical? How does that make any sense? These temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breathe and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. Ooh, that would have ticked them both off. Why? It sounds like something beyond them is in control. And they both would not have been happy. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. I love verse 26 and 27, because it's a beautiful weaving of what Calvinists hold on to and what Arminians hold on to. And it brings them both together. And it says, actually, you're both kind of right and kind of wrong all at the same time. Because Arminians on one side, the people that believe in free will, they act like that we have so much free will that it handcuffs God, that he is not able to be sovereign really in anything. Because we're the ones that have all the control. And Paul looks at them in verse 26, he says, actually, that's not exactly accurate. God has placed each person for his purposes in the exact time and the exact place. You're there for a reason. But then they would say, see, God, we're just God's puppets, the Calvinists would say. And then Paul looks at him in 27, verse 27, he says, actually, no, he put them there so that then they would have the opportunity to reach out for him, because that's as close as he put them into proximity so they could actually find him. You see, it's there. It's both. Arminians need to realize the sovereignty of God is way bigger than what they make it out to be. And Calvinists need to realize that God doesn't use us just as his mere puppets, that he plays this cosmic theater game. But there is a little bit of both. For there is free will that is governed by the sovereignty of God, for his plans will not be overthrown just because of your stupid choices. That makes sense? Moving on. Verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. In verse 28, he quotes 2 to 3 Greek poets. Number one, Epimenides, from the 600 BC, around there. He was a Cretan poet, and he once said, in him we live and move and have our being. And that's exactly what he says in verse 28. Then you have two other guys, a guy named Aratus and a guy named Cleanthes. Aratus and Cleanthes both were from the 4th and 3rd century BC. And they both, talking about Zeus, said, we are his offspring. So he takes their poets and uses it against them to bring them to Jesus. And that's actually a pretty cool missionary principle. If you go to a mission field, and your mission field doesn't have to be overseas, it could be, in rural Kansas. You've got to learn the language. You've got to learn the language. You've got to learn what if you go to another country, you've got to learn their poetry. You got to learn their music, their architecture, their history, what makes them who they are. Same thing about places like, rural Missouri, or rural Kansas, same thing. You go in there and we're going to contemporize the worship music, and you're slamming on electric guitars, and these people can't stand that. What really gets them going is country music, God help them. You need to figure out a way to communicate to them. Does this make sense? If you're a city boy that's preaching in a rural church, you need to learn what it means to ride a tractor. You need to learn what it means to wake up at 5 o'clock and to be going out to the fields. You need to learn what it means to live where they live and to do what they're doing. Otherwise, you will never be effective. I don't care how many principles you learn here at Ozark. The number one principle, learn their language and speak it. Make sense? That's exactly what Paul does. Therefore, verse 29, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. He comes back to that main point. How does that make any sense? How is that God worthy of worship? He can't walk, he can't breathe, he can't even make his own idol. How is he worthy of worship? In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world, and with justice, by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of all this to all men by raising him from the dead. Where does he go to? Like every other sermon in the book of Acts, where does he go to?
Resurrection.
He says, I'll give you someone that's worthy to worship. I have a God that actually brought a man about, and he was God in the flesh. And to prove it, after dying for our sins, he raised him from the dead. Now, that's a trick. Can your idols do that? When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, verse 32, some of them sneered. Who do you think was the first one in the group to sneer at him?
Epicureans.
Why? They believe when you die, you die. There is no resurrection in their book. When you die, it's over. When they hear about the resurrection, some of them begin to sneer, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. At that, Paul left the council, left the Areopagus. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Notice, this was not very successful. In Athens, it wasn't very successful. I actually find it quite ironic, by the way, but a lot of our apologetic classes use Athens as a model for apologetics. And I'm like, but there wasn't a good turnout. There wasn't a good response. We're going to use the model in Acts with the worst response to model how we should evangelize? That seems a bit peculiar. Whatever. What do I know? Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus. Even though they were small in number, Qualitatively, it was huge. Dionysius was one of the 30 most influential men in all of Athens. Why? He was a part of the Areopagus. And also a woman named, and the Greek pronounce it Damaris, although it's my daughter's middle name and we call it Damaris, and a number of others. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. Now, let's look on our handy-dandy map here of where that would be. Here we are in Athens. I can't make my little pointer go up there today because I'm on a different program, I don't think. Yep, nope. There's Athens. You're talking about a 50-mile trek over to Corinth. But we're still staying in Achaia. We're still staying in that general region. The region of Achaia will be important at the end of chapter 28 because of one person that we'll meet. Then, after this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. If Athens is the intellectual capital of the world, Corinth would be the commercial capital of the world. It actually is quite humorous to me because with commerce comes debauchery. Usually where there is high commerce, high business, there's also high crime, high immorality. It's just kind of a general odd principle. But anybody want to put New York's morality up against some other city? See the problem? Corinth, same way. As a matter of fact, it's humorous to me that some churches, even in America today, where they're a Corinth Christian church. And I'm like, whoa. Corinth was a word that they would even use to describe sexual immorality in the ancient world. What are you going to go? Go Corinthing around? That's how they would use it. So we call ourselves Corinth Christian Church, basically the Christian church of immorality. Awesome. And some of those churches hold true to that name, which is a travesty. Corinth, that's Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. There are several things that are very important in that verse. Number one, where are they from? Where are they from? Pontus. Why is that significant? Let me zoom the map out a bit. You see Pontus on the map? Give you a hint. It's near the Black Sea. You see it? Right above Galatia. What's significant about that region? Paul wasn't allowed to go there. Instead, he's obedient. He's not allowed to go down here to Asia. He's not allowed to go up to Bithynia. Instead, he goes all the way through Macedonia. Now he ends up in Athens, and now he's in Corinth. And he meets someone from the very region he wanted to go to begin with. God works in awesome, funny ways. Maybe you should just obey Him and try it out. It's delightful. Also, you also see that the reason why they though left Italy, even though they were from Pontus, they had been in Italy, in Rome. These are prominent figures. It's kind of like the small town kid that ends up going to the big city, and whenever he comes back, he's kind of a hero. Aquila and Priscilla, even though Aquila was from Pontus, they'd been living in Rome, over there in the far west region of the empire. But they were kicked out of Rome because of Claudius. And we actually have evidence of that happening. Specifically, that happened... where's my... Suetonius 25. There it is. Suetonius, in his book, The Lives of the Twelve Cedars, 25, talks about Claudius's reign. This happens around 49 or so. It says, since the Jews... Listen to why they're kicked out of Rome. Since the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from Rome. Why did Claudius kick the Jews out of Rome? Yeah, because they were having conflicts over Jesus, the Christ, Crestus. So the reason why in Rome Aquila and Priscilla had to leave is because of persecution from the Jews that basically the emperor says, enough, get out of my city, you're not allowed in. So God works for Paul not being allowed to go in Bithynia over here on the eastern side of the empire. He uses persecution over here on the western empire to have a meet in the middle and ultimately spread the message to every place that Paul wasn't allowed to go. That's pretty cool. Aquila and Priscilla are also pretty significant because after this moment, Aquila, who is the husband, will never be mentioned first in the list again. It will always be Priscilla and Aquila. Acts chapter 18, verse 18, Priscilla and Aquila. Acts chapter 18, verse 26, Priscilla and Aquila. Romans chapter 16, verse 3, Priscilla and Aquila. 2 Timothy 4:19, Priscilla and Aquila. What is that saying? She's the more prominent figure in the relationship. Huh. Why? Some people could say maybe it's the prestige of her family. Maybe she's from Rome. Maybe she has the money, the economically a higher status, therefore her name comes first. Even in the ancient world, that wouldn't matter. The woman would not come first. Not to mention the fact that I don't know anywhere else in the book of Acts where the names of Paul and Barnabas are governed by economics. What is the order of Paul and Barnabas' name? Why is it in that order that it is in? Yeah, who's prominent in what region? A lot of times involving prominence in what way? Ministry. Let that one sink in a bit. Priscilla and Aquila. Why is she listed first? It could be economics, but it seems to follow the pattern of Luke in Acts to list her first because ministry-wise, she's more prominent. I didn't think women could talk. Well, take it up with Luke. I don't know what to do. I don't know. He should have done a different pattern. It's not my problem. Okay. Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker as they were, what was their occupation? What was Paul's occupation? Oh, good test question. And because he was a tent maker as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Naturally, that's what Paul does. But notice his ministry here has shifted. He is now have at what we call it even the modern day tent making ministry, where he is working in order to free himself, or working in order to take off the financial burden of the ministry so that he can do ministry and work at the same time. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, coming from Macedonia, where were they at last when we left them? Berea. Exactly, Berea. And they had left what city? Thessalonica. In order to go to Berea. And what was the city before that that we left Luke in? Philippi. That'll be important in a minute. Paul devoted himself, whenever Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. What happens? When they come, what shifts? Paul stops working, doesn't he? Why? What could you construct historically happened whenever they got there of why Paul no longer had to work himself? What are some of the options? What's that?
They brought home.
Maybe. Well, how so?
That, yeah. Maybe they were making money and paying whatever needed to be paid while Paul just...
Yeah, maybe what happens is Silas and Timothy get to the city and they say, you stop working, we will work, you just go preach. And they start working to provide money for all of them. That's possible. And there's a ministry principle in that. Every person in the church has a place. Every person. And none of those places are insignificant. Timothy and Silas weren't lusting after the stage so much that they said, we will not work, we want to preach. Instead, they said, you know what? We'll work. You go preach. Why? Because that's your key gift. It's not mine. That's why some people, they'll come here and like, I was talking to a guy the other day and he's trying to finish up his degree here at Ozark so then he can go to chiropractic school. And he was like, I know they're not related. And I was like, yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. Just because you're working in the workforce out in the world doesn't mean that you're not functioning in the kingdom. The questions that I would have for you would be different. It'll be, how much of your money are you using to advance the kingdom? That's the question, because what you're saying is this is the role I feel like God's having me play in the kingdom. And I'm cool with that, and you should be too. Because not everybody is cut out for vocational ministry. That's okay. If you have a kingdom perspective, no matter what job you're doing. But if you just flat out want money, and that's why you leave, You're a fool. But if you go into the workforce because you truly believe God's called you to play that role in the kingdom, do not be ashamed of it. As a matter of fact, I'll look at you and I'll say, man, go. And you be the absolute best engineer you possibly can be so that you can free up the people that have been gifted to preach, to preach. That's okay. Because ultimately, usually, no matter where we're at in the kingdom, no matter what role we're playing, we want a different one. If you're the worship minister, a lot of times you're wanting to be the youth minister. Or if you're the youth minister, a lot of times you're wanting to be the preacher. If you're the preacher, a lot of times you're wanting to be, you know, out of the ministry. You know? We always are wanting a different role. We usually are. And no one is satisfied with where they're at or who they are or what they're doing for the kingdom. And that makes the body of Christ in complete disarray. Know who you are and maybe even the season that you're in. You will go through seasons where you will have different tasks for the kingdom. Some season you may be the head director of the Meals on Wheels program. Thank you, Stephen. And then the next season that you go into, all of a sudden, you're the one becoming the very first martyr for Christianity. Sometimes seasons change, and you need to know what season of life you're in. Nevertheless, never be ashamed with wherever God's leading you to be. You will be tempted whenever you're in a ministry for 30 years, that whenever you're coming to the end of your ministry, that you will even be wanting to split the church over not leaving. Because you will not know, you will not know that God, in fact, actually still does have a plan for your life. And it's not the one you've been doing the last 30 years. But He's still moving His kingdom through you. Trust Him. And maybe what you'll find is a weird Bithynia, Rome meeting in Corinth. I promise, everybody has a place. You got to know who you are, when, and when you are at in your season. Does that make sense? Man, if you can know, if you know whenever you're saying, you know what, it is time for me to transition and start mentoring the people that will take over me, oh, that'd be so refreshing. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. A lot of times the elder ministers have a harder time moving into a new season because they don't know how to function in the season after that season. Know who you are. Know where you're at and be okay with it. Everyone has a place. Okay? There is another option though. Yes?
I don't know if this is that other option, but would it be, I don't know, for Paul, like, going around preaching and doing missionary journeys and later, like, getting arrested, being almost stoned, like, would that not make it hard for him to have a job with people? Like,
Yeah.
Bad image, even? Like,
possibly, yeah. I mean, the PR race isn't as big as it is nowadays.
Right, but like, oh, that's Paul, the guy who runs around, like, talking about the resurrection all the time. Don't buy a test from him.
Yeah, possibly. At the same time, it's different than that. A tent maker would be a part of a guild. And we're thinking of it through a capitalist perspective because that's the perspective we've been given.
Yeah.
And so there's survival of the fittest amongst all the tanners, amongst all of the tent makers. That's not really the way they functioned back then. Matter of fact, if you wanted to go into the tent making, you would go to what they were actually called the ghettos. They weren't just ethnic ghettos, they were also guild ghettos, where you'd go to the ghetto of the tent makers and you'd buy your tents. So the survival of the fittest capitalist mode is not exactly what we're having here. So he'd be making tents that then would go be sold to the merchants that the merchants then would be selling. You'd have the tent merchant. Okay. See the difference?
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yeah. So it's much more of a trade type society as opposed to, man, my contracting business has to get this bid. It's much different. So, but does that make sense? Is everybody, your question makes total sense.
Okay.
But I just hope that everybody's understanding we got to look at it through a different lens. Because then you wouldn't have that problem for Paul. Marquise.
Could a season even last for years?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Season. I feel like I'm in the season that's preparing me for what I ultimately have been made to do. And I think that this season, I've committed to being here for at least 10 years. But I believe this is a season. I believe ultimately, my wife and I have just a deep heart for the homeless, and I think one day we'll be doing something with them. So yeah, seasons last, and you know, and God will release you from your season. Now, don't blame it on God when you go somewhere else, because people do that all the time too. Yeah, you ended my season of small churches. Now it's time to move to the mega churches. Well, that's convenient. If He calls you there, that's great. That's not a problem. I'm not against that. But a lot of people blame it on God because that's really where they wanted to be the whole time. But yeah, absolutely, seasons definitely last for years. Sometimes for like 30 years. Absolutely it is. Moses went into 40 years of wandering before he was ultimately allowed then to do what he was prepared to do, and that is to lead the people in an Exodus. Jesus was in obscurity for 30 years before he led to his 3-year ministry. His season shifted. Paul was in a different season. Matter of fact, Paul even went into obscurity for 3 years in Arabia. We don't really know what he did there. Preparing for what? His ultimate ministry. Matter of fact, every person that does anything significant in the Bible at all has a season of preparation, and then it shifts. David was a shepherd before he became a king. So absolutely it's biblical. We just don't want to pay attention to it. Philip, he was this traveling evangelist in Acts chapter 8. But we'll eventually meet him again later on in Acts, and he's been in Caesarea for the past 20 years, ministering to that one city. Where before he was traveling from Azotus, all the way, you know, everywhere. Absolutely, there's seasons, and absolutely, they're in the Bible all over the place. Okay. I like that was a Berean question, and I liked that. Are you preaching the word, or are you spouting heresy? Good question. Good question. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, the second option. It's also possible that Silas and Timothy. Brought an offering from the Philippian church to Paul and freed them up. And where I get that is in Philippians chapter 4, verse 16, Paul refers to the exorbitant financial gift that they gave to him that allowed his ministry to continue. So it's also possible that what freed Paul up was they brought an offering. Possibly they met up with Luke in Berea before they left, and then they brought that over to Paul. Does that make sense? There's a couple of options. Could be they came and started working, or could be they brought a big check from the Philippians. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them. Why did he shake out his clothes? Similar to dusting off your shoes. It's an act of judgment. Your blood be on your own heads. Whoa. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Paul does this in 3 different cities where he looks at the Jews and he says to them explicitly, because of the way you're acting and the way you're treating me, I am not talking to you anymore. I am now going to the Gentiles. 3 different cities. First one, Pisidian Antioch in Acts chapter 13. We've seen this before. Pisidian Antioch. That Antioch, not this Antioch. Oh, that Antioch. Pisidian Antioch, Acts chapter 13. He does it here in Acts chapter 18, verse 6 in Corinth. And he will do it again in Acts chapter 28 in Rome. Now, I do want to make sure I put this caveat in there. Even though Paul has a heart for the Gentiles, it didn't make him excited to write off the Jews and go to the Gentiles. That's not his goal. As a matter of fact, in Romans chapter 9, Paul will even say, if it were possible for me to give up my own salvation so that my brothers could come into the fold, I would. He said, but I can't. Because that's not the way it works. Paul's heart breaks for the Jews. But ultimately, he will not spend his time with belligerent people that refused him to listen to his message. And it is one of the hardest things in the world. Even experienced it this past semester more than once. Where you really have to just look at yourself and the people that have been investing in a person or a couple people with you, and you just say, we just got to let them go. We need to go spend our time on the people that really want to hear. That is not easy. It is brutal. But it is necessary at times. Because sometimes people, flat out, they have things in place that until they get those out of the way, there's nothing you can do to help them. And that's what's happening here. You never make that decision lightly, and it never brings you joy. But it is something that you need to be a good steward of your life and a good steward of the Word. And sometimes that's a decision you have to make. Never make it by yourself. Always make it in community. But sometimes it's a decision you have to make. It's not that we're casting you out of the kingdom. It's just that you don't want to be in. And that's okay. I can't force you in any more than the Holy Spirit can force his way into you. So you go your way, and I'll go spend my time on people that really want to hear. Man, it stinks. But it's something that that you will come into contact with. Verse 7, then Paul left the synagogue and went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. Goes right next door. That's funny. Crispus, the synagogue ruler, and his entire household believed in the Lord. What? What happened there? Paul says, fine, I'm leaving you guys in the synagogue. I'm out of here. And he goes next door to Titius Justus. And Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, says, I'm following him and my whole family's going with him. What happens whenever a synagogue leader leaves? What happens? What? Yeah, a church split. That's what happens. Some will follow Crispus and they will go with him. Others will say, no, we're staying here and we're promoting a new person that was maybe his protege and we're going to fight for this synagogue. You see that principle today as well. Crispus is pretty interesting. Matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians 1:14, well, first of all, let me finish reading this verse. Verse 8, and many of the Corinthians who heard him believed and were baptized. In 1 Corinthians 1:14, Paul is talking about this war that's going on in Corinth. Remember, that's where we're at right now. This war, after he's left, this war that's going on about, some people are saying, I was baptized by Apollos, who we'll meet in a minute. Oh, other people are saying, I was baptized by Paul. And Paul says, I am so thankful that I only baptized two people while I was there. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 14 says, I'm thankful I did not baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius. Now we see Crispus in our text, don't we? The synagogue ruler, right? Where's Gaius? Who do you think Gaius could be? Maybe he's in his household? That's a good guess. That's a really good guess. What else? Maybe a traveling companion? Maybe, yeah, possibly. In the Roman world, you would have every Roman, a Roman citizen, would have three names. All of them would. That's just what they had. Similar to us, you'd have three names. Who do you think could be Gaius? It's possible that it is Gaius Titius Justus, the owner of the home next door. Makes sense. That's why the two names are mentioned here in Acts and why the two names are mentioned in 1 Corinthians. It's possible, though, that once Paul got to know him better, he got to know him by the name that Gaius was most comfortable with being called. Yes?
Is this the Gaius of 3
John? Probably not. Probably not. Good question, though. All right. One night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent. And it makes me go, Paul's the last person I thought would be afraid. I mean, if you're giving permission to be more bold, how much more bold can it get? For I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this city. So Paul stayed for 18 months, a year and a half, teaching them the Word of God. 18 months. A year and a half. This is the longest time that Paul has stayed in any one place in the book of Acts so far. And it will only be rivaled. It will only be actually exceeded by Ephesus. In Ephesus, he will stay for 2 years. 18 months he stays because he really, in a sense, gets the confidence. The Lord says, I'm not going to let anybody run you out of town here. So Paul preaches with boldness, knowing that the Lord has him there and is keeping him there. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him into court. Gallio, this is one, remember we talked about in Acts chapter 12, that was one of the places where we could point to the exact date of Acts at the time. Remember that time? It was the death of Herod Agrippa. And what date did we give that? 44. Now, we're here. We know that Gallio was the proconsul of the region of Achaia, which is where Corinth is, of Achaia. We know he was proconsul from 51 to 52. So we know that Paul is in Corinth for 51 to 52. We know he was, which is kind of cool. While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him into the court. This man, they charged, is persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. Same accusation, just a different place. Just as Paul is about to speak, Paul is like, well, let me get my defense. Gallio interrupts him. The proconsul interrupts him. Says, hold on a minute, Paul. If you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or a serious crime, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you. But since it involves questions about words and names and your own law, settle the matter yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things. So he had them ejected from the court. Gallio says, I'm no moron. He's actually the brother of Seneca, who would be the tutor of Nero in just 3 or 4 years. He's connected to Rome in a pretty significant manner. Gallio knows probably the inner workings of Rome. What's happened just in the past 2 to 3 years? Rome has kicked out all the Jews from its city because they were arguing over somebody named Crestus. And Gallio goes, I've heard this before. You're upset with this guy because he's talking about Crestus. That's a matter you need to deal with on your own. I'm not wasting my time on this. Get out of here. Well, verse 17. Then they all turned on Sosthenes, the synagogue ruler. Crispus was the synagogue ruler. Crispus leaves, they appoint someone else named Sosthenes. They all turned on Sosthenes, the synagogue ruler, and beat him in front of the court. But Gallio showed no concern whatsoever. Why would they beat the synagogue ruler? Why would the Jews beat their own ruler? What's that? Yeah, why would they blame him? Well, it's really an honor issue. Sosthenes would have been the voice for the synagogue before Gallio. He would have been the one bringing the accusation. He would have been their lawyer. And whenever Gallio shuts him down, they say, you messed it up. Therefore, you're the one that's going to pay the price for this. Not to mention the fact, it's kind of like our courts of law today. Whenever there is a ruling that's made, let's say 50 years ago, whenever the similar situation comes up today, they will point back to that law case and say, see, because of the way that the ruling was made then, that's the precedent that I'm now going to use to enforce the rule now. You understand what that means? It's like, well, the reason why, you know, Johnny V, da-da-da-da-da, with how they ruled there, this is how we're going to rule now. Same situation here. The Christians, before a Roman proconsul, a key Roman official, have been declared innocent. That's going to make it really hard then for the Jews to be bringing up accusations from here forward. Big problem. Sosthenes jacked it up. So they beat the tar out of him. What happens to Sosthenes? Actually, this is pretty cool. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. Where is it at? What verse am I in? Somebody help me. 17. Verse 17? Oh, no wonder. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1 says this, Paul, called to be an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God, and our brother Sosthenes. What happened to Sosthenes? He converts. They beat him and he's like, you guys are psycho. And Paul says, you want to join us? Sure. And he actually becomes a traveling companion with Paul.
What verse was that?
1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. It's the technically, even though it's 1 Corinthians, it's technically the second letter that Paul writes to this city that he's in right now. And why do I say it's the second letter? Because he says, I wrote to you before talking about this, and da-da-da-da-da. I'm sorry, I've got to keep going. I have 9 minutes to get through the rest of this chapter. They beat him. Okay, verse 18. Paul stayed on in Corinth for some time. Then he left the brothers and sailed for Syria, accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. Actually, where they're going to end up is down here. Which is where? Ephesus, which is in what region? Asia Minor. The other place Paul was not allowed to go to. They sail over there accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. Notice the order of the names. Before he sailed, he had his hair cut off of Cenchrea because of a vow he had taken. We never actually hear that he takes a vow. We just hear that the vow ends. More than likely, this was a Nazirite vow or some sort of modified Nazirite vow, where what he took was a vow. A Nazirite vow would include three things normally. Never touching anything that is dead, no drinking of wine or alcohol, and not cutting your hair. Those are the three things. Why did he take this vow? Maybe it's because, I think it would be attached to a couple of things. Number one, it is possible that he took this Nazirite vow whenever he was not allowed to go into Asia or into Bithynia before. And he said, I will be in grieving until the moment I get to come back here. That's possible. Or it's possible that he took the Nazirite vow at the beginning of his 18 month to 2 years in Corinth as a means of saying, I will not rest until I finish my work here. We don't know exactly what the vow is attached to. I'm actually in the middle of my own modified Nazirite vow right now. Until I finish my PhD, the hair is not coming off. It's just kind of a thing where this is a commitment I'm making to God. My PhD has more to do with him than it does with a book or even this institution. Verse 19, they arrived at Ephesus where Paul left Priscilla and Aquila. Notice again, he leaves them in Ephesus. He himself went to the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. He's going to leave them there. He goes to the synagogue first, like he always does. When they asked him to spend more time with them, he declined. But as he left, he promised, I will come back if it is God's will. And we will find out later, it is God's will, and he'll stay there 2 years. Then he set sail from Ephesus. When he landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. Why did Paul not stay in Ephesus? Why didn't he stay? He never preached the gospel there. You'd think he'd want to stay and preach it. Why didn't he stay? He left Priscilla and Aquila there, so maybe he just thought they could handle this. Possible. There is a textual variant. One of our manuscripts kind of adds something. You don't have it in your footnotes like you normally do, because it's not a whole verse. But it says that the reason why he leaves Ephesus, because he wanted to get to Jerusalem before the Passover. He probably hasn't been to the Passover the past couple of years because he's been in Corinth and traveling. And the Passover may be no better time to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Whenever the Passover, just 15, 20 years ago, was a time in which something significant happened. So more than likely, the reason why he is beelining it back from going from Ephesus to Caesarea and booking it all the way back is probably because he's trying to get down to Jerusalem. When he had landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. What does that tell me? He went down to Antioch. What does that tell me? The second missionary journey is over. Because Antioch is always the place wherever we intersect it, that's the beginning and the end of the second missionary journey. Now the third missionary journey is about to begin. Verse 23, after spending some time in Antioch, Paul set out from there and traveled from place to place throughout the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. Notice the region he goes to in the third missionary journey. Galatia, which would have included Iconium and Lystra, and Phrygia. It's the place where he was at his first missionary journey. He's going back and re-strengthening the places that he has already planted significant churches in. Meanwhile, now we're doing somewhat of a, let's jump all the way over to Corinth again. We're actually leaving Paul. This is a very rare thing that's about to happen over the next 8 verses. Very rare. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. Who's in Ephesus? Priscilla and Aquila. He was a learned man, naturally, because Alexandria, if Athens was the intellectual capital of the world, Alexandria would have been the second intellectual capital of the world. Matter of fact, the Library of Alexandria was one of the most amazing collections of scrolls that the ancient world had ever seen. And it burned to the ground. Awesome. We lost all of that. Delightful. Alexandria, though, will be really important in the history of the church. Origen, one of our church fathers, was from Alexandria, as well as Clement of Alexandria and others. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. That's a weird, weird moment. Because if Priscilla and Aquila have the order of their names due to her prominence of ministry, That means that she's probably the one that took the lead to instruct Apollos of the ways of Jesus. Let that one fit into your theology like a square peg in a round hole. Okay. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, where did he want to go? From Ephesus to where? Achaia. Where is it? What's in Achaia? Corinth. Hence the debate in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Some are claiming to be baptized by Apollos, while others claim to be baptized by Paul. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the Scriptures that Jesus was the King, was the Christ. All right, any questions? Good old Apollos thrown in there. Matter of fact, what's really interesting, we really don't see Apollos anymore. Some people actually even think, though, Apollos was the one that wrote Hebrews. I'll let you guys wrestle with that while you're in Chad's class or Jeff's class, one of the two. Any questions, though, about anything before you guys take your test tomorrow? Yes? It's possible there was another guy named Sosthenes, although here's the irony I'd have to build up. This guy named Sosthenes, plays a significant role in the city of Corinth, and then when Paul is writing to the city of Corinth, he says, hey, welcome from Sosthenes. Is it possible it's a different guy? Sure, but historical probability says it's probably the same guy. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. Love you guys. See you in the morning.